Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS. I'm your host, Taylor, and I am back live in the studio after having a little break last week out in the nowhere with a pre-recorded show. So I am here. Thankfully, my guest is willing to be here with me on Christmas Eve. Not quite Eve, but here we are. So I'm here today live in the studio with Mike Hasty. He is a regional, not quite local, member of Veterans for Peace. And he's done just a ton of interesting travel and work and reflection on U.S. imperialism, war, and more. So hi, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me on the show today. It's a real privilege to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I guess just to start, there's so much that we can talk about, and I hope we can get into a lot of it, but can you start by just introducing yourself and telling a little bit about the basic outline of your story?
Okay, no, that's a good question. Of course, my name is Mike Hasty. I was born into a military family. My father was a career military officer, so I was born at Walter Reed General Hospital in Washington, D.C., like a lot of military brats. And my father traveled extensively. He was a combat engineer during the Second World War, spent 16 months in North Africa, and he was involved in the retaking of Kazarine Pass, which the Americans took, quite a defeat there when Rommel was the commander. And so in February of 1947, my father got orders for Tokyo, Japan. So he was there about 6 months before we got there. So he was there probably the latter part of 1946, and of course the war had just been barely over. And our ship arrived in Yokohama. We were the second shipload of dependents to arrive in Japan after the war. It was my mother, myself, and my sister, who is 2 years and 9 months older than me. So I'm going to tell you what my father's mission was in Japan, because it's interesting, because I think it dovetails into just some of the other things that I will be talking about. My father was involved in, he had a top security clearance when he was there. He was involved in some really secret stuff. General MacArthur was there, and my father's unit was the 29th Corps of Engineers. And they, what they did is they made topographic maps. And so what was going on when my dad was there, and we were there until May of 1949. So I was there at the age of 18 months, left when I was four. So what my father's unit was doing is the U.S. military was taking B-25 light bombers, and they were removing the insignias, and they were painting the planes white, okay? And then wherever the gun turrets were, they were putting highly sophisticated camera equipment. And what those bombers were doing is they were flying at a low altitude, and they were flying over parts of China and North Korea, and they were photographing the terrain. And so they were taking very detailed photographs of the terrain and also very populated areas. And then that film would come back to my father's unit, and then my father was making topographic maps. So essentially what was going on is that the United States was in the early stages of the Korean War. Mm-hmm. And so the story was actually told by my father's brother, who was 7 years younger. He was also a career Army officer. He was actually a World War II veteran. He was a Korean War veteran and a Vietnam veteran. So he retired as a major, just like my father did. My father retired in 1956 at the Presidio of San Francisco. I was 11 years old. And my Uncle Johnny told me this story at my father's funeral in 1994. My father never related this story to me. This was still secret in the family, you know, all those years. So what my uncle told me was basically what I just said. And the reason why it's important is that my Uncle Johnny was a combat soldier in Korea during the war. He was a lieutenant. And so he was combat infantry. And when he got to the field, they were issued topographic maps. And on those topographic maps were written the 29th Corps of Engineers, which was my father's unit.
So his brother made the maps for him to then go in.
Yeah, right.
So they were making these maps, how long? I mean, full year, not a huge amount of years, but before the U.S. is officially engaged in Korea,
correct.
Some time before.
Yes. Hmm. Yeah, because we started going into Korea, I don't know what, 1950, 51-ish. So the U.S. was definitely planning the strategic targets that they were going to hit. And, of course, we all know that one of the worst weapons used in the Korean War was napalm. We firebombed that country to death. You know, I don't think there was, along with the firebombing and the other bombs that the United States dropped, but I don't think there was very many structures that were still standing in what was North Korea. And, of course, during the Second World War, the United States, when the B-29 bombers came out in the latter part of the war, those bombers did horrifying damage to Japanese cities toward the end of the war. I mean, we firebombed the holy hell out of Tokyo, probably killed well over 100,000 people. We firebombed numerous cities, somewhere around 60 cities. And, of course, we all know what happened on August 6th and August 9th when the United States dropped the most lethal weapon ever known to mankind. And I was just in Hiroshima, Nagasaki this past November. I was over there. I went over there with an Iraq veteran and also a Japanese-American. She actually organized a trip. And we had about, we must have had close to 20 speaking engagements. The Japanese were really interested in our experiences, my experience in Vietnam, and then the other Iraq veteran. They were certainly interested in his experience when he was one of the first soldiers to arrive in Baghdad in 2003. So I did a slideshow. He did a slideshow. And because I'm a photojournalist, I've done hundreds and hundreds of anti-war images, including photographs that I took in Vietnam. In fact, one of the pictures I took in Vietnam was a dust-off helicopter that was in my unit. And on the front of that dust-off helicopter, on the nose of that dust-off, the crew had taken white paint and simply painted the word Y.
I just saw that photo reading through one of your articles, and I was really taken by it. Yeah. I did not know it was your photo.
So that photograph's on the internet quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I've taken so many images, and I have got some work on, you know, on the internet and things like that. Mm-hmm. So
that's an interesting full circle that your dad's work had to do with these secret photographs.
Right.
You know, these retrofitted planes.
And, sure.
Yeah, and in some ways, you know, it sounds like you arriving in Japan as a child so soon after, you must have been born near when we dropped
interesting. I was born one day before the Battle of Okinawa ended. I was born June 20th, 1945. I believe the Battle of Okinawa ended on June 21st. So I was born 6 weeks before the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
So it's all kind of framed, you know. I can see how your life story is really punctuated by these big events, then living in Japan, being around during Korea, then being deployed in Vietnam.
Sure. Right? And then after we returned from Japan, my dad got stationed at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. In fact, that's where my parents met, as in Washington, D.C. And then in 1953, my father got orders for Heidelberg, Germany. So we were in Heidelberg, Germany from 53 through 55. My father, of course, had one more year of service. So he retired at the Presidio of San Francisco a year later. So
I guess now you've done all this anti-war work for all these years. I'm kind of curious how that journey progressed, because I'd imagine growing up in the family you did with your dad, being an officer, being a military kid, going all over the place, Was it your experience in Vietnam that kind of shifted your thinking about the role of the U.S. in the world, or was it something else?
You know, I was. It's interesting that I turned 25 in Vietnam, and I entered the military in March of 1969. And I've had conversations with people who would say, "Gee, Mike, you were 25 in Vietnam. Hadn't you gotten it yet? You know, didn't you really understand what was going on?" And I answered that question was I was extremely politically naive. You know, I'm during the 60s and the mid 60s, I was going to college. I was going to a community college in Pasco, Washington. And then I was driving up to Pullman, Washington on the weekends, and I was playing in a rock and roll band. The reason why I was in Pullman, because that's where I graduated from high school in 1963, and then my father graduated from college there in 1963 after he got out of the military. So I was around very, very conservative people. We just did not have conversations about Vietnam. Of course, I knew all the news that was going on. I saw the footage of the news. Mm-hmm. You know, I certainly was not pro-Vietnam. I don't ever remember thinking that that's where we needed to be. I was just basically kind of observing what was going on and was, you know, obviously was wondering, you know, what was going to happen there. But I did not get politicized until I went in the military.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they weren't burning draft cards in Pullman.
No, they were not burning draft cards in Pullman. So I did my basic training in Fort Lewis, Washington in, you know, March, April, May of 69. And then I did my medic training at Fort Sam Houston in Texas. That school was 10 weeks long. And then when I finished my combat medic training, I really felt like I needed more training. I just didn't feel comfortable with 10 weeks of medic training. So I put in for an extended school. It was called it was a clinical specialist school. It was additional 41 weeks, and I did that in Denver, Colorado. So I was at Fitzsimmons General Hospital, and it was an Army hospital in Denver. And it was interesting that a lot of wounded were coming into Fitzsimmons during the war. So I was there for a year, and so we were getting a lot of amputees from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So I was starting to be exposed to, you know, the war injuries. And then I remember on one occasion I experienced shock therapy involving an American soldier that had been emotionally traumatized in Vietnam. And I remember on my psych rotation going in and observing them doing shock therapy on this guy. And I remember them attaching the electrodes and his body just, you know, jumping off the bed practically. And that's when I started gathering information. You know, I started, I'd ask a few questions and I'd get a few answers. When I did my medic training for 10 weeks, most of my class went to Vietnam. And then right after that 10-week course, and then I went to my extended, you know, training. And then it's interesting, a couple of guys that I was in my base, my combat medic training, were wounded in Vietnam and came to Fitzsimmons General Hospital. So I had conversations with them also. And so I graduated from that school in September of 1970, and then I got orders. Actually, I graduated in August of 1970, got orders for Vietnam in September of 1970. So I arrived in my unit, which was in the Central Highlands, in an area called An K. So I was attached to a reconnaissance support base. We had assault helicopters and Cobra gunships, and then we had three fire bases that had a lot of heavy artillery on it. You know, we had 8-inch guns, 155-millimeter howitzers. We had tanks with 90-millimeter guns. We had a lot of firepower. And so I was actually the chief medic in my unit. We had about 1,200 men. Our responsibility was to keep a highway open for convoys. It was called QL-19. It ran from the Ankei Pass to the Mangyang Pass, and we simply, our objective with those three fire bases was to keep those convoys open because often, you know, they got hit. And so what I was experiencing is we would get a hit occasionally with, you know, with rockets or mortars or a sapper attack, and we get some casualties from the field occasionally. But what I was seeing primarily is I was seeing the rapid disintegration of American involvement in Vietnam. So I was seeing the homicides, the suicides, the rampant heroin addiction. I was seeing shootouts. I was seeing racial violence. So all this stuff was going on in my unit. So not only did we have to worry about getting hit, but we also had to worry about soldiers in our own unit. Because like I've often said, the only thing worse than a heroin addict in Vietnam is a heroin addict with an M16.
Mm-hmm. Because you're not there until 1970.
Right.
Right, as you said. So right. I think most people know, you know, things are deteriorating pretty quickly
exactly.
by then in terms of morale.
Right.
And
yeah. The Tet Offensive ended in 1968. Nixon was withdrawing troops and everything. So we were one of the last combat units in the Central Highlands. Mm. So
hence the Y painted on
yes.
the
Yes. You know, everybody
helicopter.
Knew. Everybody knew then, I think most of us in my unit knew that that we were in the wrong place. And the why, of course, was basically, you know, why are we in Vietnam? Why are we still in Vietnam? And it's interesting. I just before I left to go back to the United States in September of 1971, I was in a transit barracks, and we were in Da Nang. And that's when they started doing urinalysis on us because of the heroin addiction and the heroin issues throughout Vietnam, because it was rampant. There was so much heroin in my unit. It was unbelievable. And so we were waiting to get our test results, and we were staying in a large transit barracks. I couldn't tell you how many men there were just in this one long transit barracks. Could have been 50, 60, 70 guys. And, you know, I had a camera with me, but there's some pictures I wish I had taken. And it was all of the incredible graffiti that was written on the walls all the way around that transit barracks. You would not have believed the stuff that was coming out of soldiers' minds as far as the hatred they had for Richard Milhouse Nixon and our presence in Vietnam. It was unbelievable, the stuff. And like I say, to this day, I regret that I didn't take my Miranda camera with a 50-millimeter lens and went all the way around that transit barracks and took those photographs.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least you remember them.
Yes.
You can not recreate some of it on the radio if you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis. I'm talking with Mike Hasty, Veterans for Peace, about all kinds of things, war and peace. You were talking about, you just got back recently from the 50th anniversary of My Lai.
Yeah, I, I was nowhere around My Lai when I was in Vietnam because, you know, My Lai happened in March of 1968. I didn't get to Vietnam until September of 1970 in the Central Highlands. And, you know, it's interesting. I didn't really know about the My Lai Massacre when I got there, because the photographs of the My Lai Massacre were published in Life magazine in the December 5th, 1969 issue. And there is, I don't know if you've ever looked at those photographs, but when I went to Japan this last month, I took a copy of that because I met the combat photographer, Ron Haberly, that took all of those graphic photographs. So when I got to Vietnam, I did not know anything about My Lai. But I do remember this. In March of 1971, Lieutenant William Calley was found guilty of the My Lai Massacre. And of course, you know, we all know that, it's true that that probably Lieutenant Calley, I think, was responsible for murdering about 21 innocent Vietnamese civilians. But what happened was that Calley became the scapegoat for the entire massacre, you know. Mm-hmm. And so because the captain that was in charge of Calley was a man by the name of Captain Medina, and he's the one that gave the orders to kill anything that moves. Mm-hmm. And that's what they did. That's what those 115 American soldiers did when they went into My Lai on the morning of March 16, 1968. And I met many of the My Lai survivors that were, you know, that were there that day. You know, the United States, Charlie troop went into My K4, which Charlie troop went into My Lai 4, and they murdered about 407 innocent Vietnamese people. Mm-hmm. And they shot them at point-blank range. I think there were 173 women that were killed. There were 56 infants that were killed. But the interesting thing, which that a lot of Americans don't understand, that there was another massacre occurring about a mile and a half away called My K4. So there was My Lai 4, where over 400 were killed, and then at My K4, which was, like I say, about a mile and a half later, it was Bravo troop that went in and murdered 97 civilians. Mm. And so that was never addressed when they had the trial for Lieutenant William Calley.
Hmm. And so at this commemoration, I'm curious, you got to meet these survivors and everything, and you've been to some similar commemorations in Japan, and it sounds like maybe in other places too.
Right.
What observations do you have around the way we remember and talk about war in the U.S. versus in these other places?
Well, that's also, it's also a good question because, I'm going to tell you something I don't generally say. I'm just starting to be really bold about what I'm going to say. It's something that I think everybody that's listening to this program needs to know, because what the United States was involved in, during World War II, involving, what we did in Germany and Japan, was total war, okay? It's total war. That means you kill everybody. Doesn't matter if they're combatants or civilians. And we did the exact same thing in Vietnam. Because I've learned one thing, because I have interviewed and met many Vietnam veterans that have been involved in atrocities. What I came to realize, and with doing a lot of research and talking to a lot of people, is this simple fact: you do not bring the enemy to the peace table by just killing military combatants. You ultimately bring the enemy to the peace table by killing innocent civilians, because they are military targets. The primary goal of the aggressor nation is to break the will of the people and their ability to defend their homeland. And this strategy is as old as warfare itself. It is what I call the great truth that has great silence. And that's what the American people will never, never be able to believe. Mm-hmm. Because the United States committed atrocities in Vietnam every single day. The United States was responsible for 20 million bomb craters. And that was a quote that was by Howard Zinn. So you can imagine how many innocent civilians were killed under those 20 million bomb craters. They are what I call My Lai's from the skies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what was that commemoration like? And who did you meet? And what did you learn?
Well, the first time I went to My Lai was in 1994. Okay, that was my first trip back to Vietnam, and I went back with three of my friends that were also Vietnam vets. We were a member of an organization called Northwest Veterans for Peace in Portland, Oregon. We got together just before the Gulf War in 1990, and so we did not serve in Vietnam together. In fact, I hate the word served, because I did not serve my country in Vietnam for the cause of freedom and democracy. I served big business in America for corporate profit, okay? Because war stands for wealthy are richer. And that's what WAR stands for. And so I made my my first trip back to Vietnam in 1994. That's when the four of us went into My Lai. And so we were there in country for about 3 weeks. I came back from that trip, and I developed an anxiety panic disorder. I was really going through a lot of hard times. Plus, the fact when I came back from that trip in, I believe, in April of 1994, a couple months later, my father passed away. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of issues around my father, and so I wound up actually being hospitalized in 1994 at a psychiatric facility in Portland. And so, when I went back again in 2016, I met a survivor when I was there. And it was interesting that when I was there in 1994, there was a mosaic tile mural that was there. And it was finished. It was a beautiful mural and mosaic tile. And it was finished in 1988. And so I saw it in 1994. It was a beautiful mural. What was on the mural was disturbing, because what it showed is innocent civilians in the last moments of their lives as they were being massacred by American soldiers, okay? And so when I went back to Vietnam in 2016, after being gone for like 22 years, the first thing I noticed when I started walking the grounds was the mural I saw a lot of deterioration, you know, because of the weather and all that stuff, you know. But I saw a lot of the tile being chipped off, and it just wasn't the pristine shape that it was when I first saw it in 1994. So what I did is I went into the My Lai Museum, and the first person I wanted to just talk to somebody about what I felt and what I saw. So the first person I came across was a woman by the name of Q Phan, K-I-E-U-P-H-A-N. And she had worked at the My Lai massacre site for 17 years. Interesting, she had five relatives that were massacred at My Lai on her mother's side of the family. So I asked her about the mural. I said, you know, I saw this in 1994, and I said, I really see the deterioration of it now. And she said, yes, there has been a lot of deterioration. So I told her, I said, you know, this My Lai massacre site is really important to millions of American people who are adamantly against the war. And I said, as far as I'm concerned, the My Lai massacre site is sacred ground. And she broke down and started crying. And I had this immediate connection with her. And so she, later that day, she introduced me to a man that was 11 years old when the American soldiers came in there. And he and his mother, three sisters and a brother, were in a shelter, like a bomb shelter. And an American soldier threw a hand grenade in there and killed his entire family, except his father. His father was out in the field, plowing the field with an oxen. And so the only reason he wasn't killed was because he was in the back of the bomb shelter. And so he sustained some minor injuries to his body from the shrapnel. And so I met him, talked to him. And then when I went back in 2018, which was just last March, because of Q Phan, the woman I met in 2016, she opened a lot of doors for me. So she started introducing me to a lot of survivors. And so I started meeting them. I started interviewing them. And there was one woman that was really significant. And she was 93 years old. And in one area of the massacre, in a drainage ditch, the American soldiers had murdered 170 civilians in this ditch. And she was one of the bodies she was one of the individuals that was under the bodies. So she was not killed. Okay, she was shot in two places, but she was not killed. And so I interviewed her in her home, and I talked to her. I took some great photographs of her. Her name was Ha, and I just can't tell you what those photographs meant to me. And then I met another woman who was also one of the survivors that was in that ditch under those bodies, okay? And then I met several other survivors that were in and around the massacre site. I met a woman in her home, talked to her. She was in a bunker that's right by her hut, and it was camouflaged. The opening was camouflaged. So they, when the American soldiers started coming in and firing, she took her two small children. She went into this underground bunker. And then she could hear all of the firing and the screaming and everything outside. And then long after the American soldiers left, she came out, and there were 100 bodies that she was exposed to that were dead. And so I had a conversation with her, and I, you know, met you know, a couple other people that saw the carnage, you know, the dead bodies after the American soldiers left. And so, you know, that had an incredible impact on me. And so I took a lot of really emotional photographs of these people. And then when I went to the Veterans for Peace National Convention, that was later that year. So I got back in March of 2018. And then I put together a 54-panel photo essay on the massacre, and I displayed it at the Vietnam Veterans National Convention in Minneapolis, St. Paul, in August of this, just this last August. And so, and that's one reason why I want to go back next March, because I want to interview more survivors.
Mm-hmm. And with these interviews, I mean, obviously, it's important for you, and it probably, I imagine, feels important for them to be able to share that right. this happened, right. you know, right. and to remember. I don't know. Do you see storytelling and like documentation as a primary way to kind of heal some of this?
Yes.
Is it something that's possible?
No
to
question
heal?
About it. I think for me, you know, what I do, I've spoken in most of the high schools in Portland. Okay, I've spoken in a lot of universities, colleges. A lot of high schools. So what I do is I take photographs in. So I take 8x10 photographs, black and white or color, and I mount them on 12x16 black mat board. Okay. And under those photographs, I have text. So every panel has a story. And it's important that I tell these high school kids what we as soldiers experienced in war. It's important that they know the truth, because the military recruiters don't ever mention anything about the killing process. And so it's important that these kids be exposed, because, you know, you don't take a drug. In fact, whenever you take a drug that's prescribed by a physician, there's always the side effects mm-hmm. of the drug, and you need to know the side effects of the drug. So what I do is I go in and I tell these kids the side effects of what could happen to them if they go to war. And so, like I say, I always put the photographs, the panels on the lip of the blackboard, and I grab each one and I tell a story. Because one of the things that's so important to me is to keep the memory of the My Lai massacre alive. And I'm committed to do that for the 504 innocent Vietnamese people who were murdered that day. It's absolutely essential for me to keep that historical event alive, and that's why I do it.
Yeah. And I guess it's kind of on the note of, I meant to ask you this a while ago, but you went to that commemoration with an Iraq vet, and I guess I'm curious, you know, you have this through line in your life from just post-World War II, Korea, Vietnam. What's your take and your relationship on the kind of continual war that we've been experiencing? Okay. More or less since the Gulf.
Well, listen, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the lies are all the same. You know, the chili recipe is the same. It really is. You know, generation after generation after generation. And, you know, it's all about corporate profit. It's all about lying to American soldiers. It's all about deceit. And so... you know, the Iraq vet that I went to Japan on this recent trip, a really nice guy. He has a tremendous amount of knowledge of not only what happened in Vietnam, but also what happened, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so it's interesting, and I didn't know this until I actually met him in Japan, that he had made a couple of trips to My Lai, and I never knew that. And so he had a vast amount of knowledge about what happened at the My Lai massacre. But, you know, I was invited to go on this trip. It was just They wanted a Vietnam veteran to go, and the woman that organized the trip wanted an Iraq veteran to go. And so we, like I say, we had about 20 engagements. We spoke at five universities and in various other events. And so I would show a slideshow. I had significant photographs that I talked about, pictures I took in Vietnam, and also pictures that I created after I came back from Vietnam. And then this Iraq vet also had some significant photographs and some artwork. He's a really great artist. So he showed a lot of that. But it was so important for the two of us. I know I'm like 30 years older than him. He was, you know, he's 30, I think he's 36, and I'm 73. So it was interesting when we gave our talk to the audiences, how the Japanese were really quite interested in what our experience had been, because they have not experienced war since the end of World War II. And so most of our audience, you know, there were certainly a certain percentage of the audience that were aware of, you know, the older people in the audience that had experienced World War II. And they were, you know, they were, a lot of them were small children. But their parents, of course, had experienced the devastation of that war, especially from airstrikes, by U.S. airstrikes. I mean, I met some people, Japanese, older Japanese, that were actually survivors of Hiroshima. And so, and I also I met young people who remember seeing the B-29s dropping bombs on the cities that they were living in. And so I thought that we gave a really good presentation. I think one of the things that they have to deal with is there's an Article 9 in their constitution which says that they will not develop a standing military. And so what the president of Japan is trying to do is he's trying to change Article 9, which will give the Japanese the right to develop a military. And, of course, we all know what that's going to lead to. You know, just because, you know, during the Vietnam War, one of the allies that we had during the Vietnam War was the South Korean government. I met South Korean troops when I was in Vietnam, and we all know that South Korean troops were involved in a lot of atrocities during the Vietnam War. And so that's one of the things that that the Japanese audiences that I spoke to, we got questions from them because they are very concerned about Article 9 being changed, because they're very concerned that Japanese soldiers will be involved with the U.S. military in the Middle East the same way that South Korean soldiers were involved in Vietnam. And so they have a lot of apprehension about Article 9 being changed.
Mm. Wow. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS. I'm talking with Mike Hastie from Veterans for Peace, talking about his military history, his work for peace, and all the rest. So, yeah, it's easy to forget, I think, as someone growing up in the U.S., that it's not like this everywhere. No. You know, I mean, my entire life, there's basically been a war going on in one form or another.
No question about it.
And yeah, it's almost bizarre to think about living in a country that just doesn't have an army and doesn't have military recruiters in all of the high schools and et cetera.
I know.
So I guess trying to move toward that peace angle, what do you think, after all this work that you've done, what do you think we can do from where we are in this culture in the U.S.
It's always a great question. I mean, it's like, what do we do now? You know, a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that since the end of World War II, the United States has bombed 30 countries. I mean, if I were to tell highly conservative people that their government has bombed 30 countries since the end of World War II, they'd call me a liar. And, you know, I think this is going to dovetail into something that I think it's important for the listening audience, was that I couldn't understand when I came back from Vietnam why I had a difficult time bearing witness about what I saw and experienced in Vietnam. You know, when I started talking about the horrible things that our government did to the Vietnamese, the Cambodians and the Laotians. I mean, just during the bombing campaign against Cambodia, when Nixon was carpet bombing Cambodia because the Ho Chi Minh Trail ran through there, and it was called Operation Menu. Okay, it was called, and it had to do with breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and snack. So we called it Operation Menu, and what they were doing is they were carpet bombing Cambodia. And nobody realizes that during the 14 months that they carpet bombed Cambodia, they killed 500,000 people. Okay? And so the biggest issue that I have, and I'm sure it's no different than most Vietnam veterans who come back from the war, you know, obviously those who became politicized, because I think there's only a relatively small percentage of us that got politicized because of the Vietnam War. But then again, you have to say to yourself that more Vietnam veterans have committed suicide than were killed in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Okay, there were 58,000 American soldiers that were killed in Vietnam. So more than that have committed suicide. And then now, of course, we're dealing with the fact that one American veteran commits suicide almost every hour. The VA statistics are 22 a day. But when I came back from Vietnam, for years, I tried to tell people what I felt was the absolute truth about Vietnam, that the whole entire Vietnam War was a complete and total fabricated lie. Okay, it had nothing to do with that stopping the spread of communism in Vietnam. You have to understand, in order to understand the Vietnam War, you have to understand what the French were doing in Vietnam. So here's a country called France, who is supposedly the beacon of democracy. Okay, they go to Vietnam and they occupy Vietnam for 80 to 100 years. Okay, they are totally controlling Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, and they are raping the countries for its natural resources and its cheap labor force. And all of that money and profit is going back to France. So how can a country called France, who claims it's the beacon of democracy, go to Vietnam and violate the exact principles that they stand for, which is democracy? And so when the French were beaten at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1954, the baton was simply passed to the United States. So if you do not understand what the French did in Vietnam, you're not going to understand what the United States did in Vietnam, because all we did was exactly the same thing that the French did. That's all we did. So when I came back from Vietnam and I started trying to explain to people about what I experienced and my knowledge of that war, people didn't believe me. I'd be having conversations with people, and all of a sudden their eyes would get glassy, or they would excuse themselves from the conversation, or they would change the subject matter. And I finally realized something, and this took me a long time, that whenever you threaten one's core belief system, there's an urgent need to change. Whenever you threaten one's core belief system, there's an urgent need to change that reality, because what you do is you violate people's core belief system. So, and whenever, like I say, whenever there's an urgent need to, you know, whenever there's an urgent need to defend yourself, you know, people just simply don't understand the reality of what was going on, because it totally, completely dismantles their core belief system.
Just that, yeah, you know, because America, yeah, is just, or that.
Because there's a quote I came up with years ago. I'll think of it in a second. But, you know, that was the issue that I was dealing with. I was trying to convince people what I experienced. And as a result, I wasn't able to do that. So I thought, well, I'm just not saying it right. I'm just not presenting the information right. I'm just not showing the right pictures. I'm not showing them the right books. I'm not showing them, you know, whatever it is that I need to show. So anyway, that's what I was doing, because what I was doing is I was giving them information that was tampering with their core belief system. And so that's what people do. When you threaten people's core belief system, that's what they do. They deny its reality. And I think that's what was the issue that I took me for years to try to understand. I didn't realize it was that simple.
Hmm. Yeah, it had to be all the details of what you were doing. So have you found, and no pressure here, because I would understand if you hadn't, have you found any methods that work better to get people to see the truth of your experience and of other people's experience?
You know, I mean, all you can give, and I don't cold plunge at people anymore like I used to. I try to give them a certain amount of information that will give them some wiggle room. You know, here's two quotes that are really powerful, and they're by Martin Luther King. He made these two statements in a speech that he gave about Vietnam, and you probably know the speech I'm going to talk about. He gave this speech at Riverside Community Church in New York City on April the 4th, 1967. He made two statements. He said, "The greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is my own government." And then the other statement he said, and it was in reference to the United States, he said, "A nation that year after year spends more money on military defense than it does on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death." And that's what's happening now in this country. Because he gave that speech in 1967. Fast forward to 2018, and those statements are so much worse. Because the United States is killing people in seven countries in the Middle East. You know, there are, I understand, 54 countries in Africa. And the United States has military personnel in 47 of those countries. We have 800 U.S. military bases around the world. Okay, and so I try to give information. I like the Martin Luther King quotes, but as far as me giving, you know, a statement like, you know, there wasn't one day during the Vietnam War that the United States did not commit an atrocity, that doesn't go over well, you know. And even the statement where you do not bring the enemy to the peace table by just killing military combatants. You ultimately bring the enemy to the table by killing innocent civilians, because they are military targets, because people believe in collateral damage. They do not believe that our government kills innocent people on purpose. They just don't believe that, because it violates their core belief system. And I never realized it was that simple. They just can't absorb that information. You can't feed a steak dinner to a newborn. Just that simple.
Yeah. So I guess with all that in mind, knowing that we are in 2018 and it's pretty dire and has been for a while, as you know, if you listen to the show, what's next for you, I guess? And
one of the things I want to do is I obviously, you know, like most people, I've gathered a lot of information, a lot of data, a lot of interviews, hundreds of photographs. And so eventually I want to put together some kind of a document. You know, I would like to do probably a photo book. Between 50 and 80 images. They'll probably be 5x7 images, color black and white, and then there'll be text under each one of those. Either something I wrote, a quote, a piece of poetry, but you know, we've often heard the statement, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words, but also it's interesting that a picture is worth 1,000 lies. And those are some of the photographs that I take. What I'm trying to do is expose the lies of the Vietnam War. It's absolutely essential, especially that young people know this truth so they don't get caught up in the military-industrial complex and go to war and die for a lie. You know, I've had friends die. I've had friends commit suicide. Two of my friends hung themselves. I had a friend of mine that died in a head-on car collision. I had another friend that died homeless. I've had four of my friends die from Agent Orange exposure. You know, one of them was my brother-in-law, you know. That's another war crime that people don't want to talk about, you know, is the spraying of Agent Orange in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been to several orphanages in Vietnam and photographed children who didn't have any arms, didn't have any legs, didn't have any eyes. Their bodies were contorted from the devastating, effects of dioxin. It's just horrible, some of the things I've seen in orphanages. And so, it's those kind of things that have got to be continually exposed to the American people. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, obviously, we're in turmoil right now with who's in the White House. I also want to say that Trump didn't cause it. He's a symptom. You know, all we have to do is go back to what the two Bushes did in Iraq mm-hmm. and Afghanistan and to look at some of the horrifying atrocities that we committed in the Middle East. The sanctions that we put on Iraq was absolutely devastating. It killed hundreds of thousands of infants because of those sanctions. I know there was Leslie Stahl did an interview on 60 Minutes with Madeleine Albright, who was the Secretary of Defense, and she openly admits, well, actually, the statistic was is that the statistic that was on 60 Minutes was when Leslie Stahl said that our sanctions killed 50,000 children. No, I'm sorry, not 50,000, 500,000 children, you know. Because we were destroying the water purification plants. We were destroying the electrical systems, the grids and everything. I mean, one more time, it goes back to total war. I mean, I have known Vietnam veterans that went to Iraq. I've met, I met a man by the name of Ramsey Clark, who was a Secretary of the Secretary of State under Lyndon Baines Johnson, and he went to Iraq and did some incredible investigation, wrote a book about what we had done there. I've met Vietnam veterans that have went into the hospitals and saw the infants that were dying from cancer as a result of the United States using depleted uranium in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so it's unfathomable what we have done to the people living in the Middle East, and I don't know what's going to stop it. You know, I the anti-war movement just simply isn't what it used to be. You know, and so I think that one of the things that's going to bring a lot of things to the head, as far as you know, the United States involved in wars across this around the world. And the fact that we are one of the greatest polluters in the world, just our military. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's going to bring it to a head, and we all know this, is global warming. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is going to be the major event that's going to cause people, hopefully, to come together in mass to demonstrate in the years to come, which is mm-hmm. going to be global warming. I mean, all you have to do is take a look at California. Let's just take a look at California and the unfathomable fires that have occurred there. What's it going to be like 5 more fire seasons just in California? Mm-hmm. Let's forget the rest of the world. Just California.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just like that, we are out of time. Because it just goes by so fast.
I know it does.
But thank you so much for talking with me today.
I know. I appreciate it so much. And it's been a privilege. And I just hope that the listening audience got something out of this. I know it's not the easiest thing to talk about. The only thing I can say is organize, get involved, demonstrate in the streets, because you got to stop the madness.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you so much. If you're just joining us at the end of the show, this has been Praxis. I've been talking with Mike Hastie. If you missed any part of the beginning of the show and you want to catch the podcast, you can find it either by visiting us at kyrs.org and finding my show page, Praxis, or you can go directly to the feed at soundcloud.com/praxisradio, PraxisRadio. You can also always email me with show ideas and more at praxis, Praxisat kyrs.org. I will be back next week with a brand new show.
In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people tell me there ain't no use in trying.